Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, join us as we explore issues and ideas shaping our world with today's key thinkers and decision makers. Let's get started, sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. It's Wednesday, the 13th of November. On the program today, youth unemployment in South Africa. It's now our biggest millstone. The Eskom City Power standoff. Is there a resolution? And how the so-called construction mafia is impacting engineering jobs. South Africa's latest Q3 unemployment figures, which reveal a mixed picture, shows a slight improvement in overall unemployment. That is good news, but an alarming rise in discouraged job seekers, particularly among young black African women, where the unemployment rate has reached 60%. I want to take a closer look at some of these statistics and maybe some possible solutions. Nkosinathi Matlangu is Youth Employment Portfolio Head at the Momentum Group, and a very warm welcome to you. So youth unemployment now, I would suggest, at crisis levels, as I mentioned, particularly for black African women. Are there new targeted measures that are urgently needed, do you think?
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. And it is exciting, it is encouraging to see the slight improvement, I must say, in terms of the unemployment stats. However, there is a mountain to climb, looking at how the discouraged job seekers' numbers are escalating. And you've touched on a very important fact that, black African women are still the most vulnerable group, and we have seen that trend in the past statistics as well. And looking at how can we remedy that, I think it's all about having tangible, actionable items in terms of now being very much committed to delivering programs that will get young black African women to participate in the economy, either through job placement or through entrepreneurship programs.
So what type of programs are we talking about specifically, and to what extent is this a public or private sector push?
Great question, because it's more of a both in terms of public and private partnership. Looking at where we are in terms of our skill set as a country, we have gotten promises that there would be a skills audit in terms of what critical skills do we need or do we have in the country in order for us to not import skills that we can actually harness from within. And I think it's time for us to ring fence some of the sectors to South African youth, to say whether you are in construction, whether you're in agriculture, or even in the ICT space, these are the areas where we could potentially unlock job opportunities, where we have a number of training institutions that are training on relevant skills, and let those skills be matched with a job at the end of the line. So I think that's the plan that we need to have in place, so that when you're looking at the private and the public partnership, we have institutions of higher learning that are training on relevant skills, so that post the matric results of 2024, we know that these young people will be going through a course or through a pathway that will empower them with skills that will land them onto a job at the end of the line.
When you talk to this cohort within the portfolio that you run at Momentum, how much discouragement do you discern?
It's quite a lot. However, looking at how young people look at opportunities as well, there is a glimmer of hope in as far as looking at how can we tap into the informal sector. Because through the programs that we have on the Momentum Group Foundation side, we interact a lot with young people, where we have these youth dialogues, where we can also look in terms of how do we find a solution that has got young people contributing towards. And most of all, we find that there are entrepreneurs entrepreneurial aspirations. However, the red tape that young aspiring entrepreneurs come across in terms of compliance and in terms of accessing, you know, some of the platforms for them to thrive. So that's where we come in as Corporate South Africa to say, how can we encourage government to create that enabling environment so that we can at least have the numbers moving in the right direction in as far as economic activity for young people is concerned.
And in Kosanati, that is not a new call from the private sector. Do you get the sense sometimes that government isn't listening?
I think government is listening, but it's what happens post the listening. And we recently hosted a collaborative dialogue together with government. We had the Deputy Minister of Labour, where we said, instead of having these talk shops, how about we have some tangible outcomes? Let's set up my targets to say, by this time, by this period, we need to have turned the corner. So we have seen a number of programs, a number of partners raising their hands, saying, we are ready, we've got the platforms, let's get young people absorbed into these upskilling processes so that we could have numbers looking in terms of getting young people economically active. So yes, there has been a lot of talk, but we need more action and we need it quite urgently.
I think you make a very important point there, and I'm a great believer that you can't manage something unless you can measure it. So in terms of the targets that need to be set in order to bring that rate down from 60%, are there short-term targets that business should be considering?
Yes, definitely short-term targets, and looking at how we can also motivate for a national workforce plan, which will also help us in terms of the numbers. We know that which sectors are we going to tackle and go for the low-hanging fruit in that in that regard, so that come this time, 2025, let's say mid-year 2025, we would have had a database in terms of skills that we need in the country and also the jobs that we can also channel young people into, so that we come back and we report on tangibles to say, upon the discussions, upon the planning, these are the tangibles and this is the pathway that would like more role players to embark on this collaborative journey with us.
Just a final question. Do you think that notion of entrepreneurship is sometimes an over-traded commodity? We tend to think in this country that if we encourage entrepreneurship, all our problems will go away. Many young people that I speak to find entrepreneurship very, very difficult.
It is the actual truth, Jeremy. It is very difficult, especially if you have to navigate that maze of entrepreneurship without any proper guidance, without anyone holding hands with you in terms of access to tools, to resources, and to be quite honest, access to funding, because capital seed funding is required for these entrepreneurs to unlock opportunities. And recently, I mean, we are celebrating that we are having 200 plus days of electricity. However, on the other side of the equation, now we have a water crisis that also affects entrepreneurs in their various operations. So we need to have a plan whereby we cannot say or preach entrepreneurship without the necessary tools and support in place. Otherwise, we're going to see young entrepreneurs getting more and more frustrated and despondent.
As we say, a very mixed picture as far as those employment numbers are concerned. And Kosanati Matlangu, thank you very much indeed, Youth Employment Portfolio Head at the Momentum Group.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So, will the deal between Eskom and Johannesburg work over non-payment of a massive electricity bill that could threaten the economy of the country's economic heart? Joining me now is a representative from the law firm HBG Schindler's. It's Chantal Gladwin-Wood, who is a partner in the public law department. She's been working with the Johannesburg Partnership in this respect. And Chantal, first of all, then, maybe just explain to me what the agreement between Eskom, City Power and government stakeholders means for Johannesburg's power supply. I'm wondering after this whether you have any degree of confidence.
That's an interesting question to ask me. I am confident that the parties are trying to find a resolution. As to whether this agreement is going to magically provide that solution, my confidence level is a bit lower. So essentially, this agreement, as I understand it, is part of the liaison between the parties in terms of the intergovernmental framework to resolve disputes, which the minister was mediating. So essentially, there's a bit of a billing dispute between Eskom and Joburg, and the idea is that they're going to give it to an independent expert who's going to look at the numbers and say yay or nay. There is an overbilling or there isn't an overbilling, and they're going to come up with a final number, by the 25th of November. And that number is supposedly going to be binding, meaning that whatever that number is, that's the final answer. And Joburg will then have to pay that number over to Eskom. Or if it's the other way around, Eskom will have to pay that number over to Joburg. So that's the idea.
And critical, Chantal, that this process is completed on time, in other words, expedited judiciously. And hopefully, if it is, it restores some confidence in Eskom's billing practices.
I think this is a very interesting case because we have, as the public in South Africa, we have cause for concern with the billing practices of both Eskom and City Power. And we now have this situation where these two giants are sort of battling it out between themselves, apart from being ironic, because members of the public often find themselves fighting these behemoths for the very same problem. It's interesting because in this case, City Power says that Eskom is overbilling. Now, in the court case that already happened earlier this year, there is a very interesting twist where although Eskom is calling for City Power to provide the source documents would show the basis of its dispute, City Power has refused to do that. There was also reference in the court papers to an independent person to whom City Power had previously sent everything, and that person had determined that there was nothing wrong. So that is what the public knows so far from the court papers. There obviously, I'm sure, is much more to the story behind the scenes that is not in the court papers. And that whole process needs to be run and culminate in a number of days. I have my doubts. It's a very short period of time for organs of state to move. And if we weren't able to extract the source documentation from City Power through court, I'm not sure where that leaves us in terms of the dispute resolution process, you know, as to whether it's going to be provided or not. So it is a very interesting case. I think there's a lot that the public doesn't know, and hopefully both parties will be open and transparent. Hopefully we will get a resolution by that date and we will see the reports which actually are put out by the independent experts, because everyone wants to know and everyone has a right to know what's really going on here.
That's looking towards the future, but if I've read this correctly, the agreement also requires City Power to pay the current account while awaiting this assessment report. Again, are we confident that City Power is going to meet this obligation without placing further strain on services and the municipal fiscus?
Well, I don't act or speak for City Power, but I am subject to or party to ongoing talks at a number of different levels. And what I heard yesterday was that the spokesperson, I think it was for the mayoral committee, had confirmed that City Power was going to be paying the current bill of 1.4 billion. So that is the latest information that I have, which is obviously very good, and that would be City Power keeping to that. But we also have to remember that another amount, somewhere between 1 and 2 billion, is going to become due and payable at the end of this month. So apart from City Power needing to pay the 1.4 now, there's another big sum which very shortly after the 25th will be due as well. And I hope upon hope that City Power has that money available, because if it doesn't, I don't know where that leaves us. It takes us right back to the beginning of the cycle.
Okay, Chantal, let me ask you this then. Beyond the independent assessment, going forward and assuming all of this holds water, there's also the user pay principle, I understand, which is central to the agreement. Do you think, or is there a sense that residents and businesses will support the principle if the service issues are not fully resolved? Surely that's still in the air as well.
There's a little bit of a confusion in the terminology because people use the phrase user pays in different ways. So can I just ask, are you talking about the terms of the agreement between Eskom and City Power, which says that even if there's a dispute, City Power must pay the amounts to Eskom, even if the dispute process is still running? Or are you talking about the process where the person who pays the bill to whichever entity supplies it with power is the one that uses that power?
My sense is it would be the former.
Okay. So remember, up until, what was it, October 2023, so for some 20-odd years, City Power had been paying in accordance with that principle. And every single time there was a dispute, it was resolved between the parties, and ESCOM did then make the adjustments that it needed to. And it's very odd that all of a sudden, as at October 2023, City Power's confidence in ESCOM doing what it had done faithfully for the last 20 years fell away. And that leads you to think about why we find ourselves in this impasse. Some people argue that City Power is not entitled to breach the terms of that agreement and to withhold any money on the basis of a dispute. ESCOM has a clear track record of adjusting the account where it needs to be adjusted in terms of the normal dispute resolution processes. And other people argue the opposite. They argue that when you get such big numbers as 3.4 billion, City Power, which also has to, you know, it has a duty to its stakeholders, it can't carry out its own operations and provide services to the residents of Joburg if it has to pay over amounts that it believes is not owing. So it's a very interesting impasse, which I think will probably only be resolved by a court if indeed that principle actually ends up being challenged. But at this point in time, that principle hasn't been challenged. The idea is to resolve the dispute, and City Power has said that it will agree to the decision of the technical expert on the 25th being binding. So that actually does speak to City Power agreeing that it will pay what is determined as owing.
And Chantal, just a quick one in conclusion. If there's any deviation from this agreement or failure to meet that deadline report on November the 25th, one's got to assume that there are contingencies in place to maintain the power supply. That's critical, surely.
I definitely think that that is critical, and I think that that's something that both City Power and ESCOM should be looking at. Certainly, as the residents of Joburg and the organizations that we represent for residents and businesses in Joburg, that is something that we are looking at. We all hope upon hope that this all goes well and everything is magically resolved by the 25th. But in the event that that doesn't happen, we need contingencies. So we have to say thank you so much to ESCOM. We met with them on Monday. They were very transparent, and we spoke to them about the timing of the year of them having given notice, which ends on the 8th of December for the public to make representations as to why they should not be switched off. Now, the media reports from Monday say that the agreement reached between the parties was that ESCOM is going to withdraw that notice. Now, I haven't seen that notice being withdrawn by ESCOM. That is what the media reported, but for now, I'm not 100% sure. In the event that ESCOM decides not to withdraw that notice, what we as the residents of Johannesburg have to do is we have to submit our representations to ESCOM so that it has all the information before it. In the event that all doesn't go well on the 25th and we are still sitting with a sword of Damocles over our head. But we have spoken with ESCOM about the timing, and we've explained to ESCOM that we think that a proper public participation process cannot reasonably be run over the December period. You know, schools shut down in early December, people are going away, and we've asked ESCOM very nicely if it would consider, in the event that things are not sorted by the 25th, if it would consider extending the deadline for the public participation process to run into January, giving people and businesses more time to make representations, but also not leaving Joburg without electricity halfway through December when we are all away at the coast and then we have to drive home to defend our houses because our electric fences aren't working and our fridges are off. ESCOM has said that it will consider it and come back to us, and we are very grateful for that. And they did seem very willing to engage. So although I don't have any formal communication on that, at least for now, it does seem that ESCOM is very aware of the plight of the residents and happy to engage with them. And in terms of how we deal with this going forward, I urge all residents and businesses to make sure that in the event that things don't go well on the 25th, they do make those representations so that we can do what is within our ability to do to ask ESCOM to try and find another way, if everything isn't resolved, to compel Joburg. There are other options that ESCOM is looking at as well, and they did say that they will be communicating those to
us. All right. It is, without a doubt, a very serious issue for the city of Johannesburg. Chantal Gladwin-Wood, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, you'll be well aware that intimidation, threats and even violence have become alarmingly common for civil engineers and construction professionals. This dangerous environment has led to low morale in many instances, and many professionals are considering opportunities abroad just to work in safer conditions. I want to discuss this a little further now with Andrew Clothier, who's president of the South African Institution of Civil Engineering. And Andrew, first of all, then, how widespread are these threats and why are they still happening?
Firstly, you know, it is widespread throughout South Africa. It's happening in all provinces. It doesn't just happen on construction sites, which is what the public sees as more visible. It happens through the whole project life cycle, so from design phase onwards. And as you said, it's construction mafia. They like to be called the business forum. And what they target is the 30% procurement policy that the government has set. They target that 30% value. So if you imagine a project worth 100 million rand, 30% of that is 30 million, and that is the money that these construction mafia are targeting. You mentioned morale. Yes, it has an immense effect on the morale of our engineers. And it's not just the engineers themselves. It's also their families that are getting threatened. So you have an engineer on site, and he's getting threatened on site. And it's not by one person. He's getting threatened by people en masse. And they often and they state, you know, if you don't sort this out, we will target your families, and we will make your life a living hell. So it comes down to the engineers.
Yeah.
Definitely affects their morale and their sense of safety.
Now, Andrew, you'll know that we've had protestations from police saying that they are taking this very seriously, that they are giving it their full attention. We've had interviews in the past on this program about government itself wanting to get more involved in it. What I'm hearing you say is that it's all very well to run the flag up the pole, but not a lot seems to be happening. Am I correct?
Yes. What we are struggling with is enforcement on our sites, especially preventative enforcement as opposed to reactive enforcement. When it comes to whistleblower protection, that's not guaranteed. The anonymity of the person who's doing the whistleblowing, that's not guaranteed either. So it's definitely a bad situation we find ourselves in, specifically with law enforcement. And we've been looking at solutions, and government needs to strengthen the anti-corruption laws and perhaps enforce stricter regulations. Even possibly, and I mentioned that 30% figure earlier, possibly reframing that allocation to something that is not subject to intimidation or corrupt practices.
You talk about this having an impact right up and down the value chain. Specifically, if this is happening, what does it mean in terms of the work that is being done and I guess the delays that would be as a result of this?
So I'm going to revert back to that 30% figure again.
Yeah.
So that 30% obviously is a portion of the project value. And that allocation is there to uplift the emerging contractors and to give them the opportunity to take part in these activities. So they are still doing work for the project, and they are generating outputs for the project. Now, when it comes to these construction mafias coming in and demanding money, that has an effect on costs, budget overruns, project durations being extended, projects being cancelled. And it has an impact on what they're essentially demanding is protection fees for that site.
Have you been able to quantify the total impact of this construction mafia crisis?
Not to that extent. What we do know is that, and these are the figures we have, in 2019, it affected 63 billion rands worth of projects in South Africa. And in Cape Town alone, in that same year, from January 23 to February 24, there were 96 cases of extortion recorded on sites.
Mm. So that's 63 billion. I mean, you know, that was 5 years ago. So I'm sure that number has increased incrementally.
That figure is increasing. No, absolutely. Mm.
Is it mainly aimed at public sector projects or private sector projects? Or, you know, is everybody a target here?
I think it's mainly aimed at public sector projects, as because they have that 30% policy in place, where they have to allocate 30% to emerging companies and so forth. Private sector, I think they've managed to stay out of the limelight, but I think they're not going to be able to stay out of that too much longer. But certainly it's mainly public sector at the moment, although I think private sector will be getting hit hard as well.
And Andrew Clothier, you mentioned the morale issue. I'm assuming then that if there is no morale and you're worried about your safety and that of your family, you're going to say, I don't want to work here anymore. I'm going to look for opportunity elsewhere. If you're a civil engineer, you're highly skilled anyway. Explain to me, if that exodus is happening, what it means for the industry in South Africa, and link it back to the economic impact, because that's effectively what the big concern is.
Yes, yeah, so engineers have been leaving South Africa for a while now. The main reason being that these South African engineers, they are classified as world class, and their skills are sought worldwide. And because of how the infrastructure and landscape currently looks in South Africa, it makes sense that they emigrate and ply their trade elsewhere. Where elsewhere in the world, such as Europe, Saudi Arabia, Australia, construction activities are quite plentiful at the moment. And the main reason for them working abroad or leaving South Africa is job opportunities, safety, financial reward, and the growth factor in your own profession. And yes, it does have an effect and a ripple effect on South Africa's economy. We have less skills where it's needed. We have less opportunities for mentorship for those recently graduating, less succession planning, less succession in skills transfers. And that the gap to unskilled as opposed to highly skilled is now widening. We end up with a situation where we have a lot of junior engineers and we have a lot of highly skilled senior engineers on the verge of retirement, but that gap in between is slowly disappearing.
Mm, no question that this is a very grim issue. Andrew Clothier, thank you very much indeed. President of the South African Institution of Civil Engineering, I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program, the Johannesburg Planetarium is being reimagined as the cutting-edge WITS Anglo-American Digital Dome. It's set to open early next year. Peter Bezuidenhout is Director of Development and Fundraising at WITS and joins me now. And Peter, first of all, what motivated the transformation and what are you hoping it brings to the broader community?
Jeremy, maybe just useful to reflect on where we came from. So the dome was opened in 1960. And by our calculations, we probably got about 4 million feet through the dome over the 64 years prior to us refurbishing it. Incredible. I mean, for many, many people, it was the average person was probably a young kid coming from Limpopo, their first experience of Joburg and the big city, and this sort of experience of seeing, you know, the sort of astronomical experience was phenomenal. But again, you know, the advent of new technologies, the advent of big data across so many disciplines, you know, all of this has come together for us to create this incredible immersive experience. You know, so we've got state-of-the-art projectors, we've got state-of-the-art sound, and we're starting off with a couple of shows we've got from the American Museum of Natural History, and there are around astronomy, but the opportunities that this presents to delve into disciplines such as, you know, biology, anatomy, climate modeling, digital arts, all of these disciplines that we sit with at WITS that have these massive data sets that have the potential to be visualized and for us to conduct really deep research at the dome, as well as to create our own content, is immense.
And Peter,
so it's a
given,
really exciting opportunity.
Yeah, and given our poor track record in South Africa as far as STEM subjects are concerned, critical that this makes science and technology, I guess, more accessible to younger South Africans. Your intention, I guess, is also to drive long-term interest here.
Completely, you know. So I spoke about the school kids, which is a big market. But, you know, starting with our own, you know, hopefully the dome experience is going to be something that gets embedded into the academic curricula of all students here. You know, the fact that it's about interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, that's what knowledge is about nowadays. You can't just sit in your own silo and say, you know, I'm doing chemical engineering and I learn about ABC as I always did. It's this interrelationship of all these disciplines that makes it so exciting. So we start with our own. Then, we're going to, it's also going to be a major research facility, as I covered. And then, obviously, the sort of outreach. So the outreach to a raft of school kids, hopefully, that can come in there, you know. Every morning, We can have 200 people, you know, seated in the dome, hopefully do sort of maybe sort of 1,000 to 2,000 a day. That's really exciting. And then weekends will be sort of for town and gown for the citizens of Joburg to come and experience. So it really offers immense opportunities for us to get the story out
there. And Peter, you've got to stay on your toes here, because when it comes to major tech projects, often patchy delivery can be a challenge. Your big focus is going to be to make sure that the Digital Dome maintains high tech standards in the long term. You've got to be on it all the time.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Jeremy. So we can purchase excellent content, you know, from offshore providers. But obviously, what we really want to start doing is producing excellent local content. And you're spot on there, you know. And this is really high-tech 8K stuff. There's a hell of a lot that goes into producing that sort of content. And obviously, we want to build that capability locally.
I see what's in it for Wits University, but you've got a lot of money from Anglo-American. What's in it for them?
So, you know, it's a phenomenal sponsorship from Anglo-American. Building on a 100-year relationship, we like to say we built the city together, and we did. But also Anglo are deeply committed to the rejuvenation of Joburg, working with, I'm sure you've heard about Josie, My Josie.
Indeed.
This initiative run by Robbie Brosen and many others. And, you know, Anglo are doing some phenomenal work in the old Main Street campus. And we've also got a presence there with the Wits Business School. So I think it's part of Anglo actually recognizing where they came from and also committing to a really exciting future. This Wits Anglo partnership has got a long way to go. There's so much that we can do together with them. And yeah, I think it's going to prove to be an incredibly worthwhile investment for everybody.
Well, certainly, hopefully puts Johannesburg on the map again. Peter Bazadenhout, Director of Development and Fundraising at Wits University. Good luck and thank you very much. On our last online poll, I asked how you rate the city of Johannesburg's brand. 73% telling me it's weak, 20% resilient, and 7% say it's still strong. And today, associated with one of our bigger interviews, the Eskom City Power Agreement. Do you think it'll hold? Do you doubt it? Or you already have contingency plans in place? If you have a view, please participate either via X or LinkedIn. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.